Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
People can make a big impact by eating more whole plant foods. And even though not everybody is going to be willing to cut out meat or interested in that lifestyle, they can still make a big impact on their health and the planet by reducing their animal intake and eating more whole plant foods.
That's author Sharon Palmer. Her new book, The Plant-Powered Diet, talks about any number of ways to reduce the amount of animal products in your diet. Today, she answers your questions. In the kitchen, Chef Daniel Orr depends on his oven for baking biscuits and roasting a chicken today. And we visit a local orchard that makes apple cider on a press from the 1940s. Very cool. Stay with us. Food news of the week. Here's Luann Johnson.
Well, Annie, we waited as long as we could. But when this news was recorded, there was still no official word from Washington State about the vote on GMO labeling. If the Washington Secretary of State's office is to be believed, the measure failed 55-45%, but labeling advocates aren't conceding defeat just yet. Opponents, including biotech giant Monsanto, spent a total of $22 million to fight the legislation, three times more than those in favor of labeling spent. Last year, California's GMO labeling initiative failed. Maine and Connecticut passed laws requiring labeling this summer, but those laws won't go into effect until other states pass their own GMO labeling laws. Another food labeling story made headlines. Remember pink slime, the leftover trimmings from beef production, also called, quote, lean, finely textured beef? It's commonly used as a binder in ground beef, but it grossed consumers out so much last year that some companies, including McDonald's, dropped it from their products. This week, one of the world's largest beef processors, Cargill Incorporated, announced it would begin labeling packages of ground beef containing pink slime. The USDA maintains that lean, finely textured beef is safe to eat. Starbucks and McDonald's have posted calorie counts on their menus for years. Come next summer, the remainder of chain restaurants in the U.S. could have to do the same. A provision of the federal health care law requires restaurants with more than 20 locations to list how many calories are in their menu items, both on the menu itself and in the drive-thru. Indiana State Department of Health Wellness Coordinator Lindsay Boza acknowledges that most people don't pay attention to the labeling. Nevertheless, there's been a significant change in the menus themselves as restaurants introduce lower calorie options or reformulate their existing dishes. The FDA was supposed to finish the labeling requirements 2 years ago, but has been trying to answer objections to some of the details. It's now hoping to finalize the rule by year's end and have it take effect next summer. And sad news to end our cast today. Trailblazing chef Charlie Trotter died this week. His self-named Chicago restaurant opened in 1987 and, according to the Chicago Tribune, became one of Chicago's premier cultural institutions almost immediately. It closed in August 2012. Many notable chefs worked in Trotter's kitchen, including chef Graham Elliott of the TV show MasterChef. Preliminary results of an autopsy showed that there was no evidence of foul play, and Trotter did have a history of seizures and strokes. Read more about these stories on our website. Links are in this week's podcast post. Find them at eartheats.org.
Yep, and Twitter and Facebook. Articles and recipes posted there throughout the day, throughout the week as well. Connect with us at Earth Eats. Thanks to Luann Johnson.
See you next week.
The export market is becoming more and more important to U.S. farmers. While the final numbers haven't been tallied, it looks like American farmers may have shipped a record $140 billion worth of products overseas in the last year. As Harvest Public Media's Bill Wheelhouse reports, farmers are taking advantage of a new way of getting what they grow to consumers across the ocean.
Every day, U.S. consumers buy products shipped in from overseas. That means shipping containers from all over the world unload here in the U.S. those 40-foot-long containers you might see on the back of a semi or stacked on a rail car. Modular transportation, or container shipping as it's called, started about 3 decades ago, says Peter Friedman with the Agriculture Transportation Coalition.
The first cargoes to start migrating into that were clothing, shoes, electronics, all the things we sort of import from Asia these days and they find at the stores.
After unloading, there were lots of empty cargo containers that had to head back overseas.
But then agriculture started migrating into those containers as well.
Usually, corn, soybeans, and wheat headed for export are poured into a giant vessel and 3 weeks later arrive at an Asian or European port. The goal is efficiency. Get as much delivered as you can at an affordable price. Empty shipping containers and American farmers looking at the export market were a match made in heaven. Now that's changing a bit. Today, Friedman says there's an expanding niche of specialized grain products grown in the Midwest and wanted overseas.
If you want to deliver to a foreign customer a product that has been well taken care of and not crushed at the bottom of a hold of a ship, you need to have it in smaller quantities. Some people want genetically modified. Some do not want genetically modified. Some want this kind of soybean. Another one, another strain of soybean.
And that, he says, can be done by shipping it via container. Bill Rabin is a farmer near the Ohio River in southeastern Illinois. He chairs the Illinois Soybean Association. I caught up with him as he was getting ready to start harvesting his 2,500 acres. Rabin says farmers can get some extra money for some of the soybeans when they do specialized shipping.
Well, that's always been a concern of the farmer. You know, we always want a little bit more for it whenever we have a specialty crop like that. You do get somewhat of a premium if you have a specific trait or a protein oil that they're looking for.
Still just a small slice of the export market, these smaller shipments are adding up. Container shipping has seen annual growth at nearly double-digit levels in recent years. A couple of hours south of Chicago, agribusiness giant Archer Daniels Midland recently opened a facility that brings modular transportation to the heart of Illinois farm country. Farmers or grain elevators truck in their crops where something resembling a giant forklift takes the container off the truck and loads it onto the train, much like a robot playing with blocks. That evening, Illinois corn or soybeans will be sent off to ports on either coast or the Gulf of Mexico. ADM's Mark Schweitzer is the managing director of intermodal and container freight.
For us, container freight is becoming a huge part of a niche business that gets inventory to the customer who wants smaller shipments.
By smaller, he means a couple of truckloads sometimes. It can help an overseas company that can't afford a full giant shipload as global financial markets have been growing slowly, or a company in a place like Vietnam where the infrastructure is not in place to handle the huge grain shipments. And on this side of the ocean, Mike Steenhook of the Soy Transportation Association says it allows small businesses to export their product, even when they don't produce enough to fill a ship. Along with farmers, he says, grain elevators and co-ops could have an arrangement for overseas purchasing.
Yeah, there's an opportunity to farmers to not just be involved in growing, you know, crops, but also marketing those crops even internationally.
In a sense, in an agriculture industry with constant consolidation, this more recent method of transportation may open up some space for those who want more independent control. Bill Wheelhouse, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website. That's harvestpublicmedia.org. Sharon Palmer is a registered dietitian and the author of the new book, The Plant-Powered Diet. She defines herself as somewhere between a vegan and a vegetarian. Now hold on a second, meat eaters. Before you start thinking that she's trying to convert you with her book, hear her out.
A lot of times people consider a plant-based diet to be limited to some sort of a vegetarian or a vegan meal plan. But in reality, a plant-based diet, it's really, the definition is simply a diet that focuses on plants and includes fewer amounts of animal foods.
So this leaves the door open to all sorts of people, from vegans to omnivores.
People can make a big impact by eating more whole plant foods. And even though not everybody is going to be willing to cut out meat or interested in that lifestyle, they can still make a big impact on their health and the planet by reducing their animal intake and eating more whole plant foods.
We put the call out to our Earth Eats Twitter followers to ask her any plant food related question they wanted. Here's an excerpt from the conversation she and I had over Skype recently. One theme that kept recurring amongst the Twitter folks was this idea of eating whole foods. First of all, tell me three or four plant foods that we should all be eating, that we might not be eating already.
Well, I really like to advocate eating more legumes. Lentils, beans, dried peas. There's a lot of research that suggests that if we ate about 3 cups a week, which is really about 1 serving a day, you could really make an impact on reducing heart disease, obesity, type 2 diabetes. There have been links with those particular conditions. So that's one plant food that we really need to start eating more of. It's a a cornerstone of so many traditional diets. If you think of the diet of Mexico or South America, beans were a central feature. And in Asia, tofu, soy foods are a central feature. In addition to legumes, nuts and seeds, there's just so much evidence now that a handful of nuts a day, which is about 1 ounce, you can gain a lot of health benefits. You know, that's a great healthy habit to get into, is 1 ounce of nuts a day. And they're high in protein. So that's a really good way to kind of like skim off some of the animal protein in your diet.
Mm-hmm.
And then whole grains. We're just not eating enough whole grains. The average American is supposed to be eating at least 3 servings a day, and we're not there. Whole grains are rich in so many different nutrients, in particular fiber, along with a lot of vitamins and minerals and phytochemicals. But the fiber is really good for your heart, digestive tract, and immune function. So, whole grains are really high in protein. Some whole grains have up to 11 grams of protein per cup, which is, that's even more than 1 ounce of meat.
Mm-hmm.
So, you're not only getting all those great benefits from eating whole grains like the fiber, but it can also replace some of the protein in your diet.
Well, this is a perfect segue into a question from someone on our Twitter feed. He said, grains, should they be avoided? Paleo folks say yes.
Yeah, that's a popular diet right now, is avoiding all grains. And I don't agree with that. I don't feel that there's enough evidence to suggest that humans should be avoiding grains. In fact, we have a body of evidence that says whole grains are really good for us. We have hundreds of studies that are showing that people that consume more whole grains weigh less, they have lower rates of heart disease, lower rates of type 2 diabetes. So, I think the bigger conversation is that people are consuming too many refined grains. We're consuming way too much white flour, which is easily absorbed into the bloodstream, and it's a source of refined carbohydrates. And that's really the bigger problem. But I advocate eating whole grains, and hopefully in their natural form, which would be there as the whole kernel. So that's what I really advocate, is eating more foods that are close, what I call close to the earth or close to the soil. If you can see a whole grain kernel in your hand, that's exactly the way it was grown and picked off the plant. But by the time it's been ground and added to crackers and cookies and white flour and bread, you can't even recognize that whole plant food anymore.
Yeah, well, Sharon, this has been fantastic. Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Sharon Palmer's new book is called The Plant Powered Diet. Read more about that and listen to our entire conversation on the website. While you're there, check out her other Q&A articles about superfoods and gluten-free eating. Read it all at eartheats.org. Coming up, Chef Daniel Orr picked up some cooking techniques when he was working in Anguilla.
Whenever they're cooking birds, they always put lemon on it, and I think it's partly for sanitation reasons. The acidity is good for it, but it also creates a real crunchy, crispy skin.
He'll give other tips and tricks for making the perfect roast chicken coming up in a few. production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all four locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. A visit to a farm for us to start off the second half of the show. Musgrave Orchard only has about 300 trees, but with those few fruits, they're able to make some pretty fantastic apple cider. And get this, they're still using their original apple cider press from the 1940s. Take a listen.
My name's Andy Hamilton, and I am the owner-operator of Musgrave Orchard. This is a 80-year-old apple orchard. I actually bought the orchard from the Musgrave family 10 years ago. When we first bought the orchard, it was conventionally grown, and we were able to transition towards organic production, which was our goal. We only have 300 trees. Sounds like a lot, but production orchards have anywhere between 6 and 8,000 apple trees and could have anywhere from 10 to 20 varieties of apples. We're somewhat limited. We're dependent on local orchards in the area to get the varieties of apples that people want and the right mix of apples that we want for our apple cider. But regardless, apple cider that's fresh from the farm, you can't beat it. We try to leave the cider house open so people can come out and take a look at it and get an experience of what this machine looks like and what makes Indiana's finest apple cider. And it has for 87 years. So nowadays they have these newer cider mills that are compact, where we have this dinosaur. And from one end to the other, it's about 30 feet long, and it's got different components to it that make up the entire cider press. We'll harvest our fruit and we'll put them in these big 18 bushel wooden bins, which can weigh 1,000 pounds. The apples, as you open this gate, roll out onto this stainless steel table here, where they get rinsed, any debris gets sprayed off of them, and then they land in this wooden hopper, and it carries the apples up. So it grinds them up, makes applesauce, and it falls down through this chute right here. And so you build it 10 high, and that pedestal press pushes all those cloths up against this butcher block here. And it takes about a half hour for it to completely press all the juice out. And so if you can imagine that stack of apples being about 3.5 feet tall, when it's all done and pressed, it's about 1 foot tall. So it squeezes almost every drop of juice out of the apples. We make apple cider and we win awards for it. It's just something neat to put in your orchard to say, hey, we make really good cider.
Thanks to the folks of WTIU's The Weekly Special for this segment. See the video they captured with Andy Hamilton at Musgrave Orchards on our website, eartheats.org. Chef Daniel Orr has a mean apple butter recipe, but we don't want to overdose on apples, so we're heading into the kitchen now. How about a recipe to enjoy with jam or a compote or apple butter if you want?
I'm going to show you the recipe for my grandma's buttermilk biscuits. It's a fourth generation recipe that's been in my family in southern Indiana. We used to feed the farmhands that when they would come in from the fields. Now you better hold it just for the weekends and enjoy them once a month. So the flour is chilled. I've got these nice pea-sized pieces of butter. Sometimes I even put them in the freezer just to make sure they're really nice and ice cold. Okay, we're going to add our salt, baking soda, baking powder, and sugar. And the recipe is as simple as that. Now what we're going to do is just kind of mix all those ingredients together. And then I'm going to take my biscuit cutter and just start cutting up those pieces of butter until it becomes almost like a coarse cornmeal. And the reason you want the butter coarse is it's actually going to melt and steam, and that's going to give some part of your rise to your biscuits, so they're nice, light, and fluffy. So once we have this fairly coarsely cut up, and there's still some nice big chunks of butter in there, we're going to add our buttermilk. If you don't have buttermilk, you can take regular milk and just add about a tablespoon of vinegar per cup, and that will instantly turn your milk into buttermilk. I'm going to add about 3/4 of the milk in, and then I'm just going to kind of toss the mixture together, and you're just going to mix it enough to bring the dough together. You don't want to overmix it. You don't want to heat the dough up. Okay, and that's about a perfect dough. You can see the butter chunk still inside. You haven't overworked it. We're going to put it down on the counter with a little bit of flour. Pat it out till it's about the same thickness as your dough cutter. You don't want to twist your cutter, because what that will do is it will break up your little layers of butter that we spoke about earlier. So when you look at the biscuit, you should see those nice layers of butter on the inside. And then what you always want to do is to make sure at the end you have some scraps like this. And those you just kind of break up and you cook those on the side, and those are for the cook. And then we'll have some wonderful biscuits to have our apple butter on.
Chef Orr says that there are two tests for a new cook looking to get a job in his kitchen. First, make the perfect omelet. And then next, what we're going to do today, make the perfect roast chicken. His first bit of advice, use the best ingredients possible and cook it simply.
What I like to do is always rinse my chicken first, inside and out, and then rub it with lemon. And this is something I learned down in the islands in the Caribbean when I was in Anguilla. And any place where it seems like it's hot, like in India, whenever they're cooking birds, they always put lemon on it. And I think it's partly for sanitation reasons. The acidity is good for it, but it also creates a real crunchy, crispy skin. And you just stuff them inside. Okay, I've got some rosemary. Got some homegrown bay leaves that my mom grew. Okay, put some thyme and even some mint. Now, depending on what kind of chicken, if you're doing like a Greek chicken, stuff it with a bunch of mint, and then you can serve it with kind of a lemon yogurt sauce. I've got the garlic. I'm just going to cut the garlic in half, and I'm going to put half of it kind of at the entrance of the chicken, towards the back. If I put it all the way inside, it wouldn't get roasty because it would be insulated by the rest of the chicken. This way, it's going to kind of get a roasty flavor and perfume the bird. And then the other half, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put that in the pan. Okay, then you just kind of twist these little arms under so it looks like it's laying out for a suntan. And then a lot of people will truss a chicken. That means that they'll tie the legs together, kind of cross the legs. But I think that it cooks quicker if you leave it open because that exposes the thighs. But if you want to make a real pretty bird, you could always cross the legs. You can either stick a toothpick or a skewer through there or tie it with twine. So basically, you know, that's the way that your chicken looks before you put it in the oven. We're going to take it over here. I'm going to just rub it with a little bit of oil. Just kind of giving it a nice little, like, suntan lotion. Rub it on there. A little coating of kosher salt. A little bit of crushed pepper. And then I'm going to also rub a little bit of chopped garlic on the outside of the skin. Now, you want to rub this in, kind of give it a nice massage. And then if you want to, you could also season a little bit on the inside of the cavity. I'm using a little bit of my Greek garlic spice rub, but you could use any of your favorite seasonings. All right, and now the bird's ready to take over to the oven. Now, a lot of people don't do this step, but I think it's pretty important. We've got a hot pan on. Okay, we're going to put this guy breast side down in the pan. Okay, what this does is it helps develop a really nice crispy skin. Flip it over.
So you're just getting some char on the skin with this.
Well, we're doing that, but what we're also doing is we're building kind of a caramelized crust on the bottom of the pan, and that will give us a nice juice at the end to use as a sauce. Okay, you have a little bit of that lemon juice and herbs and stuff left on your platter that you were massaging and seasoning the chicken on. You can dump those in, and then you could use either white wine or water or a combination or even chicken stock. Okay, and we're going to put about an eighth to a quarter inch of water in there. What that's done is it's released the fond or the caramelization of the pan, and it's also going to keep your chicken from burning. It's going to make your pan easier to clean up after roasting because it won't have all that stuff stuck to it. All right, now we put this in a 450-degree oven for 15 minutes. Then we're going to turn it down to 325 and cook it an additional half an hour, and we'll come back in about 45 minutes. Slice you off a little taste. Are you a dark meat lady or a white meat lady?
No, I'm normally light meat, but let's go with the dark meat, the really tasty stuff.
Okay, dip it in that juice. Moist, you can taste the garlic, the lemons in there, the rosemary, the fresh herbs. And again, use whatever you want. If you like to go like a, let's say, a Southwestern style, you could, instead of the regular seasoning, you could use a little chili powder on it, throw a bunch of cilantro and limes in it, and all of a sudden you've got kind of a Mexican chicken. You could rub some curry on it and serve with yogurt sauce. You've got an Indian chicken. You can take it all over the world just by using different seasonings.
We kept picking at this chicken until we devoured the whole thing. Man, it was good. View a photo slideshow of the prep process and follow along the next time you roast a chicken. This is a great recipe as the temperatures start getting colder and colder. Find it at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, the folks at Musgrave Orchards, Chef Daniel Orr, Sharon Palmer, and the entire reporting team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all four locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Next week, it's hard to believe it, but Thanksgiving is right around the corner. And starting next week, we'll give you tips and tricks for making this year's feast the best yet. Looking forward to that. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Annie Corrigan.